Hello and welcome to the Nothing Venture podcast with me, Arish Shah. Today, I am really excited to have back with me for the second time on the podcast, Hussein Kanji via Zoom. Hussein is general partner at Hoxton Ventures, a London-based VC firm investing at pre-seed and seed, focused on startups seeking to invent new market categories or transform large existing industries. Hussein, great to have you back here with me today.
Great to be back on.
Amazing. So in our last podcast that we did together, which was actually more of a webinar, back in 2021, you kind of took us through a whole rambling, rampant kind of rolling background of various challenges that you faced and so on whilst you were getting into venture. But for the benefit of our audience and anyone who's sort of tuning into the podcast for the first time, it'd be great to get a bit of a resume of, you know, everything you've done and how you sort of ended up getting into venture and founding Hoxton ultimately.
Yeah, so I mean, just like the easiest way is probably chronological. So accent's American, grew up in New York City, went to a good public school, state school, but UK vernacular. It was one of these schools that you tested to get into, and so ended up with a lot of smart kids who then went on to do interesting things. And then I wanted to get as far away from those smart kids as possible because they all went to mostly the Ivy League, so the Harvard, Yale's, Princeton's, et cetera, or like the feeder schools for our school. And I went to a very unknown school at the time. It's a lot more well-known, which is Stanford. And Stanford was not back in the day like the number one or number two school that everyone kind of wanted to go to. It was a little bit further down, but it was a very good school. And I was sold on the idea that I could get away from all my type A classmates. And I was also sold on the fact that it's like a country club. It's like you got bright sunshine, it's got grass, you can take your exams out in the grass. Like it was very liberal and West Coast.
Very collegiate, right?
That thought appealed to me. Yeah. So I went out to Stanford. NTSA Mosaic, which is the precursor to Netscape, which is the precursor to Firefox and Chrome, for all the people who are much, much younger than me, had just come out in 1993. So my freshman year in college, first year in college, is when the browser stuff started happening. I then interned at a web design agency that freshman summer, which is also where Wired magazine was, and their online presence was called Hot Wired back in the day. And so you ended up just getting to meet a lot of the people in San Francisco and the Bay Area on this stuff. And lots of these people I met went on to do like really interesting things downstream. And then a handful of people who I knew decided to assemble and set up a company. So my second year of university, we set up a company. We ended up designing websites for people. We did a whole bunch of like very marquee type of customers like HP and Apple. We wrote a book that became a bestseller in 1995, teaching people. We basically hacked in an era where there was no CSS. We took tables, which were designed for spreadsheets, et cetera, and like presenting information because it was markup language. And we used them as a design hack to actually turn them into a grid. And then we would snap things to the table so that you could actually do more professional looking design. Like it's really weird, but like prior to us, and it was literally us, the web was gray. And like we made the web look like what it did today.
So
and
almost like the book became the box methodology of CSS, but via tables or whatever, right?
It was not CSS, it was like tables. So like, how do you hack the HTML to actually make the stuff on the screen look much, much nicer? And it was us, we were literally the protagonist for this, and then everyone then kind of copied our techniques. And like, and that business ended up getting merged with two other companies and got bought by KPMG, gave us a little bit of pocket money. And then I went to the Advanced Technology Group at Sun Microsystems, because at the ripe old age, I think I was like either 18 or 19 at that point, you know, I knew a lot about web infrastructure compared to the average person, which is like not a very high bar. So I spent 2 years with them. It was mostly like these distinguished engineers at Sun Microsystems. So the great research group or great advanced technology group is less research. It was trying to like apply the research, but it was also a place where nothing really happened, right? Because Sun was like booming and Sun was a hardware company. And then you had all these like software legends like in my group. But you know, they were there as experts, but they weren't really like producing anything. So it was kind of a great experience. The person in my group who has since become like really well known is a fellow by the name of BJ Fogg. And BJ at that point was a postdoc, I think, at Stanford, he joined around the same time as like one of the younger protagonists in this group. He wasn't one of the distinguished engineers. And BJ went on to run something called the First Wave Bit Lab at Stanford, which is the lab that trained all the product managers at Facebook to do the dopamine hits. Like, you know, how do you tune the news feed so you keep coming back to the news feed? How do you tune Instagram? That was all BJ's work. Like that is literally like his purpose. Like that was his PhD thesis, his postdoc, et cetera. And he set up his lab and has become very, very well known among that group. Among those group of product managers, because like he gave people the tools for how to do that, like how to like interface psychological behavior with kind of design. So it's a really great group of people. Like being around interesting groups of people is a good thing generally in someone's career. And then I went off to do another company. The company didn't go anywhere. It kind of collapsed in the dot-com bubble. Got to meet a bunch of the venture community. Really like this idea of like being on the venture side because like from what I could tell they had like great jobs like investing in these things and not necessarily being responsible for the building of any of these things. But I was like, that's how do I get that job? I talked to one of the venture firms and the partner there who became more influential to me downstream basically sat me down and said, look, like if you come into the venture fund now, we'll like train you for 2 3 years or like work with you for 2 3 years and then we'll kick you out and then we'll send you to business school, et cetera, because there's not really a career path for you inside any of these firms. You know, you'd be much better off working for companies and learning how companies really work and then coming into a venture firm and coming in more laterally as like a more senior person and someone gets invited into the partnership because these are like small partnerships. So didn't end up doing that, ended up working for another company. That company didn't go anywhere. It was not my company. And then the angel investor in that company was an old professor of mine at Stanford, and he had this idea to take some research out of a research lab. So the government in the U.S., the military in the U.S. specifically funds a whole bunch of research laboratories for nuclear power, a whole bunch of stuff that's strategic to the military. And one of the pieces of kit that they built was what we commercialized, and you would see it at the airport nowadays, but next to the X-ray machine, there's a millimeter wave radar machine. It has two yellow feet pads. You put your hands above your head, it kind of spins around you. So they built it like 10, exactly. They built it like 10 years ago, and we took that and commercialized it. And commercializing it was largely a hardware commercialization. It was like figuring out how to make bill of materials much, much smaller because it's a very expensive machine that was built in the lab and not really designed for commercial use. And then there was this idea of putting a software stack on it so that the software could actually figure out the threat detection because the images that come out of the machine are really quite provocative. They're not sensual, but like they're not images that you would, if you saw them, you wouldn't want to go through the machine. So the question is, could you train the AI or the neural network to do this kind of stuff? And the problem with neural networks is you have false positives and false negatives. False positives is like it thinks you have a weapon and you don't have a weapon and someone pats you down. And false negatives is you do have a weapon and it doesn't detect it at all. And we could not make the neural network work. I mean, there's a whole research effort on training this neural network. It was like 85%. You could bump it to like maybe 88%, but you couldn't get it into like the five nines, like 99.999%. No, because we didn't have deep learning. We didn't have any techniques that we do today. We probably could. So the way we solved it was, you send the image to a separate room that is nowhere near physically next to the person who's going through the machine. And then you have a grid, and the operator in the private room map like looks at the image and says, this area, this area, this area, problem areas. And then the grid lights up next to the operator. So you see a mannequin and you see a grid overlaid on top of the mannequin, and that's where you get patted down. So the design hack, the engineering solution is the image is processed by a human, but not by the operator. So the operator, so it looks like technology, but it's not technology. It's like it's a AI, it's like anonymous Indian. Like, you know,
Well,
it's a,
I've just got to butt in here for a second. So we have you to thank, all of us sort of brown-looking people in the world, for all of the like egregious pat downs that we've had since 2001. Is that correct?
Well, no. That you have the U.S. government to thank because, but we sold them kit to help like automate the pat downs. Like it wasn't our idea to go racially profile people. And to be fair, the machine doesn't racially profile people; it just pats you down. Like it's this whole security theater that has become intrinsic at the airport, and I legitimately think it's theater because if you know how these machines work, you also know how to avoid, like you know what to do to avoid, like to get around the machines. And it's not that hard. You can Google this stuff. I'm not gonna share it, but like, it is theater. It makes you feel a lot safer by going through like a lot of these checks and balances. Anyway, we sold that company to L3, which is now makes it. I then moved up to Microsoft to Seattle to go learn how a big company works. Because again, the advice I got from this venture firm was like, you know how small companies work, but you should really learn processes, systems, et cetera, how big companies work. And at that time, there weren't that many software companies in the world that were really good. There was Oracle, which is a sales organization. There was Adobe, which is like really transforming and was kind of a bit of a laggard. And there's Microsoft, and Google was still a very young company at that point. And there was no, there wasn't that much other stuff. Salesforce is still a young company, et cetera. You wouldn't go to PeopleSoft, et cetera. So I went to Microsoft, learned a lot of Microsoft, spent 4 years there, and then relocated to the UK and joined Accel, which is a venture fund. Was on what I thought was a partner track position. Maybe I was just like kind of smoking something, but that's kind of what was promised. And it wasn't a partner track position like 4 years later. And I left, and then I needed a job. And I was convinced that the UK and Europe would produce interesting tech companies. And there really weren't that many people investing in tech companies here, and almost definitely not at the early stage. There were very few funds in Europe, and most of them had started in the dot-com bubble and were slowly going out of business by around this era, which like, to me was opportunity, right? Because that means your competitor set is actually going away. And this foolish idea to go raise a fund, we did that. It was two of us, me and Rob, and it was much harder than either of us thought. We thought it was going to be like a 12 to 18 month fundraise, and we figured if we weren't that good or it was longer, it was probably going to be a 24 month fundraise. It was a 39 month fundraise, which meant for 39 months you kind of had to pay your own salary and like kind of keep yourself alive. And you have this sunk cost fallacy where you all learn about it in school, which is like at some point, like it's a sunk cost. Like you should just walk away from the sunk cost and start. But like at 24 months, which is like our time limit for doing this, it's like we just spent the last 2 years of our lives doing this thing and it's unsuccessful. Instead of walking away and saying we're going to start from scratch and go do something else that's more productive with our time, I was like, no, we're going to double down. And it's like the exact opposite of the sunk cost fallacy. We're going to go make it happen. And it took, another 39 months, another 15 months on top of that to kind of get there. We did get there, and then we started investing. And the investing, the thesis turned out to be actually really solid. We probably missed some stuff because we were too slow in terms of fundraising, but we did well in terms of the things that we picked. Some of those companies have now gone public. We've done really well. And then on the back of that, we raised a second fund. It was also hard because there wasn't enough traction in the first fund to show definitively that the second fund, and people would look at the companies and be like, we don't really know if these are high quality companies just yet. But by the time the third fund rolled around, enough time had gone by that these were legitimately high quality companies. It was very easy to raise the third fund. The third fund ended up becoming a 200 and I think technically a $14 million fund. I always round up to 215. And it was much higher than what we thought we were going to raise, which is about 125. So quite a bit. And the first fund, we kind of fell short of goals. Second fund, we fell short of goals. Like it was a big step change. And each one roughly doubled or doubled and a half. Like, so like we really grew like the fund up. And now we're like and one of my partners like regularly tells me, like, you think of yourself as an upstart. And you wired yourself as like a bit of a rebel and like, you're doing it your own way, but you are now establishment. Like it's like, 10, we will be 10 years old as a firm, not including the fundraise, like just 10 years old live as a firm, like this November. You're now part of the UK venture as like seed stage establishment. And you guys should now think about yourself as like one of the funds that's like kind of here to stay. Like you don't have the existential risk that you do when you're first raising, and you need to like now elevate your game. So we're spending some serious cycles on like what this means and like how we want to, like, we probably now have to plan for the next 10, 25 years of the firm, because it's like we're not, hopefully, fingers crossed, like we're not going away anytime soon, which is always a question mark, like 5 years ago, 7 years ago, 10 years ago.
So we're going to get into a lot of that in the main podcast. So let's talk about Hoxton sort of in general now. So you talked about Fund 3 being $214 million. So talk us through kind of the geographies, stages, verticals, check sizes, the Hoxton rights. What's the general thesis of the fund?
Yeah, so when we first set up, we thought we'd raise a $100 million fund, and that didn't work. I mean, no one was going to give us $100 million, so we ended up becoming a $25 million fund, and that's what the bar that we set. We actually ended up going, beyond that. And the goal for us was to then, like, with that kind of pocket of money, like, the only thing we could do is seed. And so we wanted to be an early stage firm, and became a seed firm because you can't really do Series A's with like 25 to 40 million bucks. It's too small. So we became a seed firm, and that's what we did. And we wrote smaller checks, like kind of in the $500,000 to $1.5 million. And our biggest check ever was Darktrace, which was 2 million, because we used as much of our reserve as possible to invest into this stuff. And the idea was we were going to find brand new market categories where we thought the European company that we were seeing had an edge on the rest of the companies in the world. And the rest of the companies in the world could be China or Israel or US. It was almost always US and Israel versus China. Chinese companies tended to stay in China, didn't really go into the international markets until very recently with like ByteDance, TikTok, et cetera. Even that was an acquisition, Musical.ly. So we were focused on new category creation where we thought the European company could actually win the category. We weren't doing copycats, which is kind of flavor of the day back then for the European markets. We were trying to find like global iconic big tech companies that were like in their little segments were going to dominate that market. And then our job was to use our US connections and our kind of our Bay Area, like Rolodex, to figure out, are we seeing best in UK? Or are we seeing best in Europe? Or are we seeing best in the world? And if we're seeing best in the world, we kind of want to go all in on things. We still do exactly the same thing today, even though the fund has grown like a lot from that early, like from that early days. But now our check sizes are between $500,000 to $5 million. And we split our fund into basically two. About a third of our fund is pre-seed, where we are doing things literally off of a sheet of paper. Like no company has been formed, or a company has been formed, and one of the founders is there, but not all the founders is there. Like it's like early, it's like no different than an angel investor. And we're doing usually we say $500,000 to $1.5 million, but usually $1 million to $1.5 million for those kinds of companies. Like, so we're putting $1 million like straight in the sheet of paper type of investing. And it's turned out that we are better at that investing, which is weird because you have no data like at all, right? And there's no company. But we thought we'd have like a 1 in 10, like kind of 1 in 15 hit rate, maybe if we're really lucky, 2 in 10. And then our second fund is 7 of 12. And the third fund feels kind of the same. It's much higher. And when I say hit rate, I mean like companies that then go on to raise seed, that go on to raise Series A, go on to raise Series B. I don't know if they're going to get all the way to the distance, but they're definitely massively outperforming the rest of the pre-seed companies. We've turned out to be really good pickers on that side. And then we're doing seed, and then seed checks have actually gotten a lot bigger in Europe. We probably can't do the seeds that an American firm would do, but we can do seeds between 2 to 5 million. And that's kind of our seed bucket. And if the round's like a $6, $7, $8 million seed round, which is not hasn't been unusual the last couple of years, then we tend to co-lead with someone else. And we almost always lead. So it's usually us. And it's or it's us plus one other person. We don't do like the like, follow checks, like we're putting a call. If we're in, we're in. Like and then we'll work really hard kind of behind the scenes to be as helpful as possible, which kind of makes us stand out a little bit. And then because we're like this, we end up with, and we're a small team, we end up with a big load in terms of like we have a lot of companies that we can look after. So I'm on 20 something boards, closer to, I think officially the number is 23 or 26. I have a very busy schedule, just like in terms of working with the companies. And we're the most active passive investor. So like there are a lot of investors who have board rights for like control reasons, or like they want to like dictate the strategy of the firm, or they want to influence what the company's actually going to do. We care less about the direct control type stuff. We care a lot more about being behind the scenes, having the hard conversations, having the easy conversations, being the sounding board. So we're very active, but we're not active in the way that most activist investors who are like telling the company what to do or thinking. We're just active in the sense of like we want to be the call that you make the minute there's any kind of turbulence, the minute there's any kind of question marks, the minute anything kind of happens in the business. Like you should feel very comfortable picking up the phone, even if you don't feel like calling the other board members or convening a board meeting. You pick up the phone call. So we're very active kind of behind the scenes, and then we're pretty pushy, I would say, on like trying to make these companies as best as like the best version that they can be. So We push hard on hiring. We push hard on unit economics. We push hard on like making these companies as resilient and as like as fundamentally good as they possibly can. And we have a really high tolerance for these companies. At the end of the day, are all like they're all broken. They're never going to be fixed. You can't run them efficiently. You know, the question is like, can you fix the one thing that allows them to scale? It can then live to fight another day and then fix some of the other things that are also broken. And over time, they become a lot more resilient. But even if you opened up the hood and looked at like a Facebook today or a Meta today, you would find it is less than an ideal organization of the big company now, right? So like we're very forgiving of what these companies need to be. But in the areas where like they need to win and be truly excellent, we're not so forgiving. We put a lot of like we put some pressure and we work really hard to not just put pressure, like to arbitrarily put pressure, but to like put them in front of people and put them in front of stuff that would actually help them recalibrate and aim even higher. And we're reasonably good at doing it.
So, let's talk about some of the companies in the portfolio or even outside the portfolio. So if you were to think of kind of three ventures that you're really excited about at the moment, what would they be?
So I'll give you three examples. So like we have our historical stuff. So the historical stuff doesn't make us any more money. Like it's kind of already done. Like, so, Deliveroo, Darktrace, iconic companies, Babylon, iconic, and then fell off a cliff, unfortunately, because of what's just happened in the last week. Hasn't actually technically fallen off the cliff yet. Like they still have 30 days to kind of rescue themselves. And I would not count them out because like these guys like pull off miracles all the time. But like, those companies, people know. I would say in the next batch, like interesting companies, like, so we have an AI drug. It's not drug discovery. It's like drug fixing. So you take a broken drug, you put it through our engine, we fix the drug. And we specifically fix a particular kind of drug called in that have some, that has something called intrinsic disorder in a protein. And intrinsic disorder just means that part of the protein is not that stable. And the AI and the biophysics extension that we have is able to fix that. And that it's a new category, like software creating or helping improve like the drugs. And we've taken one drug that failed clinical trials and we've turned it around and it's in the middle of clinical trials right now. Like I actually think that's a super exciting company. So that's one. We have a fashion company that takes signals from TikTok and Instagram, figures out what's trending, and then manufactures that clothing kind of in a just-in-time basis and releases it back onto the same channels. And they're doing really well. I mean, they're growing like, anywhere from like 10% month on month to 80% month on month. The last month was like 60%. It's really high and they're controlling their growth. I mean, if we told them just go all out and grow, they could go even faster than that. And they are like borderline break even. Like, so it's actually really quite interesting. And it's a fundamentally good business, even though it's very young. And it's in the millions of revenue a month. And they have a generative AI product that they're working on, which I think could be really quite interesting, where the AI can help design the clothing. I think that could be like really super, super exciting. And then we have a company that we haven't disclosed yet, but it's a legal company that is able to redline contracts and edit them. And again, all of these, if you look, the overarching theme is new categories. There's some underlying technology innovation that allows these companies to get born. And then if we're right about these kinds of things and these companies end up, these categories become big categories and the companies win the category, then I don't think these are like $10 million, $50 million type of exits. I think these are like billion-dollar type companies in the making. And that's the reason why we're excited about them, because they all three kind of illustrate that.
Amazing. So we're gonna dive into some further background about the fund, where things are going in a second. But for the meantime, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, my pleasure.